Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. Rob Hart has worked as a book publisher, political reporter, and author of the Ash McKenna crime series. His acclaimed novel, The Warehouse, is a near-future thriller set in a giant tech company and shows what happens when Big Brother meets big business and who will pay the ultimate price. Today, Rob is in conversation with fellow author Alex Segura, who wrote the new Star Wars book, Poe Dameron: Freefall. Join Alex Segura and Rob Hart as they discuss, among other things, just how close we might be to the dystopia of The Warehouse.
All right. So, Alex, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Rob? What's happening?
You know, obviously not much. The world is a very calm and inviting place at the moment, and there's nothing to be in a constant state of anxiety about.
Yeah, no, it's good to live in really boring times.
Yeah, man. I don't know. It's like, it's bizarre. I was in Manhattan yesterday and just like walking around. It's just so weird, man. Like there's a third of the amount of people you would expect to see. Wow. Still weird tourists kind of like gumming up the sidewalks, but you know, it's just, it's been a trip. How are things up in Queens?
Good. I mean, I haven't been into Manhattan since March, maybe early March. Just, I guess everyone has, it's interesting to see everyone's different thresholds of what they're willing to do or willing not to do during these crazy times. And we've pretty much stayed in the neighborhood, just kind of locked down, hunkered down, which is surreal.
Yeah, which I think is the smart thing. I feel like, you know, at least in New York, we've kind of got this thing, not beaten, but at least like, you know, wrestled to the ground. It makes me feel bad for other parts of the country where it's like, man, like, you guys got a ways to go before this gets back to being any kind of normal.
Yeah, that's the scary thing. It's not like a switch being flipped. Like, it's not going to change from one day to the next. It's gonna be a gradual process, but so we're here to talk a little shop, I guess, which is fun. We've done this at events and stuff. So what's on your desk right now?
What book is on my desk?
Or what are you working on?
Oh, so I'm working on Paradox Hotel, which is my next book. And it is, I think I'm on like the second or the third edit now. And it's a time travel book. So it's like, it's finally starting to come together a little bit. Which is nice. And I think it kind of makes sense, but we're going to find out in like a month when I start sending it to people to get some feedback. Mm-hmm. And you're working on Secret Identity right now, which I am dying to read.
Oh yeah. I can't wait for people to be reading it. It's to read it. We just announced the deal at Flatiron, and it's a standalone set in New York in the 70s. And it stars this woman who moves from Miami to New York to work in comics, and she gets caught up in a murder mystery. But there's also a lot of other cool stuff, you know, involved in the book that I think we'll be rolling out as we get closer. But that's my top priority these days.
And, you know, we both have book releases this month, which are obviously happening in the age of pandemic, which is not the most fun thing. I've got the paperback of The Warehouse, which came out last year. And you've got the release of your Star Wars novel, the Poe Dameron book.
Yeah, and you have a short in that Empire anthology, so that was a trip.
Yeah. It's kind of fun to play in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, it was it was remarkably liberating. You know, I think you always go into any of those work for hire situations, you're not sure like how hardcore the IP owners are going to be, but the Star Wars team was pretty open to anything. They just said, you know, do whatever you want, bring in whatever ideas you want. Obviously, this is your sandbox and play as much as you will there. But
so,
you know, having some, oh, go ahead.
You know, I mean, it's obviously, it's going to be a pretty big release. I mean, it's a Star Wars book. Like, how does it feel having to do it now, during the age of pandemic, when it's like, you can't even go to cons or do bookstore events or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of bummed. I like that part of the process. I love interacting with the fans in person. And, you know, conventions are part of my job at Archie. So I feel like I'm missing out a little bit, but we've got a lot of virtual events, and I've seen a lot of like stuff on social media, you know, people taking pictures of the book or interacting in some way. So I don't feel like it's completely going into a void. You know, there was always that fear, like, how do you release a book during a pandemic? Have you seen the same thing? Or
You know, it's been kind of weird. Like, I don't know what the, because this is the paperback release,
right?
You know, a year after the hardcover release, which the hardcover release went very smoothly and went very well because obviously we weren't in the middle of all this.
Right.
So I don't know what that would have looked like. I don't know what we would have been doing differently. Like, they sent me, my marketing team, which is incredible, sent me like a really comprehensive list of like the stuff that we're aiming for and the stuff that we're going to be working on. And you know, I've got a few things to do on my end, and I am going to see about maybe doing a few virtual events, but for the most part, it's like, it's pretty straightforward. Like, this is sort of like the easier part because the book's already been out. Like, now we're selling the paperback. We got like, so we got a nice boost from the hardcover. And I guess the only thing that's really different now is just contending with the fact that like all this stuff that I made up in the book that I thought wasn't going to come true for like, you know, 10 or 20 years, like literally came true in the 7 months since the book came out.
Yeah. I was going to ask you what has it been like, you know, when the book came out, it seemed like such a extreme vision of the future. And now, you know, 7 or 8 months later, you're seeing stuff actually happen. Is that terrifying or do you feel validated or both or?
I don't know. I mean, validating is not necessarily the right word because it's sort of like, I guess I could say I told you so, but it's like the meanest and worst I told you so ever. Right. But like the whole point of writing the book was to show like what the grift of capitalism was, that it's like, it's designed to give people as little protection and support as possible. And we're supposed to just accept it because it's the system we have and it's the best we can do. And, you know, the entire system relies on paying people as little as humanly possible, you know, just enough so that they can survive. And then the people at the top end up taking everything else. And then they try to like make it seem like it's our fault that that's happening. And yeah, I mean, to go to this place where like we have the financial market collapsing, the rental market collapsing, you know, and at the same time, you know, we see CEOs are raking in record profits. And they're getting like these huge stimulus deals from the government. And meanwhile, the government is fighting over whether they should like extend unemployment for another few weeks for all the people who like can't feed themselves.
Right.
But like, that's the thing. That's the hook. It's like, you got to keep, you can't give people too much. Cause if you give people too much, you know, they might realize that they have a little bit more power than they thought. And I don't know, like I was talking to my therapist about it and he was like, you know, how does it feel to like see all this stuff come through and come true? And I'm like, you know what, honestly, it's depressing.
Yeah, not
it's
great.
It's really depressing because like you don't write a book like that thinking like, oh, the world is going to end and everything's terrible. Like, I feel like when you go into a story like that, that's kind of like a bit of a polemic and like a little bit of that speculative, you know, I see this problem on the horizon and we have to address it. I feel like you naturally go into that with a little glimmer of hope, you know, because you're telling a story where, you know, you want to believe in the best of humanity and you end up in this place where it's like, oh, it's all coming true. And now people don't want to wear masks because nobody believes in science anymore. And then you just kind of feel like, yeah,
this is how it ends.
Yeah.
But I do. I mean, I think just knowing you as a writer, a lot of your work is so research intensive that there had to be some expectation that, you know, reading the tea leaves and doing the legwork to kind of make sure your book felt true, there had to be a chance that it could come true in some way.
Oh yeah, no. And I really did think it would. But again, like I figured like 10, 20 years, cause like, and people would ask me that all the time, you know, like when is this book set? Because it never says in the book what year it's set in. And I did that on purpose because I didn't want to date it. I wanted all the technology in the book to be at least close enough to what we have today so that it didn't feel like super fantastical. It wasn't like ray guns and space stations and all the stuff that we don't have yet. It was like tracking watches and then these big giant fulfillment centers and these sort of like live work facilities. It's things that we can understand. And so my joke was always like, people would be like, when is this book set? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, for the most part, it's already here. And now it's like, oh God, it's already here.
Yeah, it felt like the not very distant future. And, you know, the way I saw it, just from an outside perspective, it was a fairly whirlwind launch for the book. I mean, you announced it, you got the movie news, and then rolled into a pretty exciting, you know, on-sale date in the first few months. What's it been like looking back at it, like with some perspective, I guess?
It was pretty incredible, you know? I mean, it was, I think... everyone at Penguin Random House did such an incredible job on this book. You know, it blew me away the kind of effort they put into this. And, you know, because I'm used to, like, we both published with a small press before this, and, you know, and it was a good press, but it's also like a lot of the responsibility falls on you as the author to do things. And like,
right.
To have like a lot of this stuff taken care of for you, it's like it's liberating, because it's like, oh, I get to actually focus on the thing I like to do, which is write.
Right. Yeah.
So it felt really good, and I'm glad that I at least got to have some of the fun. You know, like I got to go to the UK, I went to Italy, I went to Amsterdam, I went to Germany. You know, and then my French tour got canceled. I was supposed to go to Quai du Poulard, and I was going to be in like Lyon and Paris. And that was like right at the beginning of the pandemic. And for 2 weeks, it was like, is this going to happen or is this not going to happen?
Right.
And so really lately, it's just been like trying to keep up with everything. Like mostly things have kind of quieted down, like the foreign publishers or like some of them have already come out. Some of them haven't yet. It doesn't seem like there's any sort of like big impact on them yet. I mean, some of the publishing houses I've worked with overseas, like, are closing. Like it is hurting the industry, but like my Italian house closed, which was really sad because like I loved everyone there who I was working with. But right now it's like, I mean, looking back, I'm glad that the book came out when it did, because mm-hmm. it wasn't like during this whole period. And now it's just sort of like trying to keep up with things, you know, as they stand. Cause like, so I was just recently talking to Imagine Entertainment, and they're still working on the script for the book.
Right.
And so the big challenge right now is, so I was talking to the president of the company, Karen, and she was like, what's going to happen is when productions start again, all the productions that were in the midst of filming, because like so many movies are half finished and so many TV shows are like half shot, that they're going to get first dibs. But after that, like, there's nothing to do in Hollywood right now but develop. So everyone's developing stuff. So it's going to be like this big giant group of people at the starting line, like ready to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Imagine has been incredible to work with. And to their credit, they're like, we do still see a pathway to making this movie. It's good. Now it's just a matter of like waiting and seeing what happens. Because we don't know, you know, if you're optimistic, then, you know, you look at the what they're reporting about the vaccine development, that we might have something by like end of this year, early next year. But you never know. I mean, this could be with us for a while.
Yeah. And a vaccine isn't a one-off. You know, as we know with the flu vaccine and things like that, it's not a one-for-one thing. It could be an evolving vaccine each year. But yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic. One thing, you mentioned the glimmer of hope earlier, and I think that still exists. You know, I'm not ready to just kind of resign myself.
Well, you know, and I really do think in a lot of ways, so one of the things that was always kind of interesting to me, and I referenced this in the book, is how like, we are sort of we love like dystopian tales of like classism. You know, there are so many examples of them. And it's funny because it almost seems like we never seem to listen to them. You know, like we never really get what they're saying, which is like the elites are out to get us. Like we are the food they eat to grow bigger.
Right.
And so we enjoy and we celebrate these stories, and then we don't always like follow through on them. And there's a character who like very specifically says that in the book, where it's like, you know, what lessons did we learn from like Brave New World and Fahrenheit 451 and 1984 and Handmaid's Tale and Fight Club and et cetera, et cetera. I think now more than any moment in history, people actually are really waking up to this stuff. You know, I feel like there's, and this is like non-scientific and sort of like vaguely anecdotal, but I feel like, you know, 2 years ago, Twitter used to be this place where it was like, you know, people were just like making jokes about like the dessert they had, or like, you know, it was just trading dumb memes. And now like, I see so much like Black Lives Matter and like bring out the guillotines and why are billionaires making more billions when I can't even afford to feed my family.
Right.
And there seems to be what I think we need right now, which is anger. Like people are sort of waking up to the stuff and they're getting angry, which was the whole reason I wrote the book. It's because I was angry, you know?
Would you say, I mean, that leads into my next question. Would you say that's the big lesson from the book? You know, be angry, speak out, you know, don't just roll over.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I think that was always sort of like, You know, the thing that I went into the book believing very strongly, and I still do believe it in a lot of ways, is that the system that we have is so big and so complicated, and it's so dug into our lives that, like, it's unfixable.
Yeah.
You know, like, we really kind of have to tear it down and start from scratch. But, like, what does that even look like? You know, like, that's, like, the only solution is sort of the impossible solution. So,
right.
But nothing is going to change unless, like, we wake up to these things and we get angry about them. And it's like,
right.
We should be angry about the fact that, like, you know, you've got airlines are, like, accepting all these bailout dollars, and, like, they're still, like, laying people off because, like, executives don't want to take a pay cut. Like, we should be upset that, like, Jeff Bezos is now officially the richest man in the world, and, like, Amazon has turned this incredible profit during this, and, like, their workers still don't have the appropriate PPE protection to, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, they're not getting the appropriate amount of protection and sick time, and we're relying on them for so much right now because so many people don't want to leave the house.
Right.
But it's like, you know, this was an opportunity to kind of, like, reset things a little bit and say, okay, you know, this is, like, because if 3 or 4 weeks of, like, people not being able to work completely crashes the economy, then we have a bad economy.
You know? Something's not really clicking.
Yeah, like, it showed how incredibly fragile this all was. And so it was an opportunity to say, okay, how do we fix that? Like, how do we shore that up? And a lot of the answers are really obvious, which is, like, you know, give people the money they need to stay home for, like, 4 to 6 weeks so we can really kind of tamp this thing down. And instead you see governments are like, no, we have to get people back to work as soon as possible because we don't want to pay unemployment and we don't want our 401ks to start tanking. You know, it's like the party that used to complain that, like, you know, we wanted to build death cults around, like, the healthcare system are now building death cults around the economy.
Right. Yeah, it's terrifying. Like you said, we both have similar backgrounds in terms of, you know, we wrote two relatively acclaimed PI series, and you jumped into this, your first standalone, which is speculative and relatively dark. I mean, pretty dark. And I'm jumping into a sci-fi novel. What were some of the challenges you faced, you know, doing that? Did you feel like you were jumping too far too fast, or was it something that you felt like, you know, I use these five novels to kind of get my sea leg?
You know, I never really felt like the real problem I felt was after I was done. You know, it was never an issue writing the book, you know, because I've always read a lot of sci-fi and speculative fiction and I've always really liked it. So it never felt like completely foreign to me. And to my mind, the book is really like a mystery slash thriller. So it's like still in my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that's been kind of weird is after it came out, I feel like I'm standing in several different streams, you know, because it's like, it's hard to peg down. Like, yes, it's speculative. Yes, it's a little sci-fi. Like, yes, it's a thriller. Yes, it's kind of a mystery. You know, some people are calling it satire. I wouldn't really call it a satire, but I also wouldn't really argue against that. Like, it's this weird thing where it's sort of, it sits in all these different categories, you know? And so that sometimes leaves me feeling a little drift on what to focus on or, like, who to focus on when it comes to, like, getting the word out about the book. But
I guess it just kind of shows how entrenched we are in terms of genre, which is really a marketing tool. I mean, that's how I see it. This is how the term they use to market your book versus how you should feel your book fits, you know? But it can be limiting because you're kind of taking a piece of everything. You're kind of, your foot's in almost every subgenre, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Which on the other hand was like a huge boost for me because it meant, like, you know, getting to go to Comic-Con and getting to sit on a panel there, which, you know, normally I wouldn't have been able to do because you're not really like a straight crime mystery author is not really getting that kind of slot. And, you know, it sort of introduced me to a new sort of like world of writers that I get to hang out with. That's pretty cool because, like, and I knew writers like, you know, Chuck Wendig and Delilah Dawson and Adam Christopher, you know, before this, but now it's like, oh, cool. Like now we're sort of like, we're running in the same circles and working with the same editors. And like, now we get to go out for drinks more often.
You're comrades, I guess.
Yeah. So it sort of also like widens the circle a little bit and makes it a little bit more fun because it's like, yeah, I'm standing in a lot of streams right now, but that also means that there are more streams for me to play in.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about Paradox Hotel at this point?
You know, not a whole lot. And yeah. Here's why. It's still in the process. It's a very twisty book. It's a very challenging book. It's because it's sort of in the same wheelhouse as The Warehouse, you know, in the sense that it's about how billionaires are like very happy to let the world burn as long as they make a profit. But it's the most fun I've ever had writing a book. Wow. Right. Because it's time travel. And I've always wanted to do a time travel novel. It's got dinosaurs in it, which, I mean, is really hitting my, like, you know. Yeah, like the 6-year-old in me is thrilled. Like between the dinosaur and the sarcastic Scottish robot, like I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
And but it's also like there's an emotional core to this book that I'm really, really happy with. And I think I think I'm close to making it land. You know, it's one of those things where, like, because I'm in the middle of the editing process, I go back and forth between thinking like, hey, this is really good, and wow, this is the worst piece of garbage I've ever written.
But void, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's just been an absolute blast because you know, I'd been working on a book before this and it didn't really come together. And just recently, a mutual friend, another writer, Todd Robinson, was saying, you know, you did not, like, the excitement level you have for this book is so off the charts, which you did not have for the other book at all.
Right.
But, cause I had got, he's a bartender in the West Village, and I go to his bar sometimes where he's doing window service to hang out. And I was freaking out because, like, I had this great idea. I'm like, well, there's time travel. And so there should be Atlantis truthers. There should be people who are like, Atlantis was real, and they spend all their time and money trying to find it. And he's like, and apparently I just kept on doing that. Like, I would just get stuck on these weird little ideas and get really excited about them. And, but yeah, man, like, time travel is just so much fun to play with.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine the challenges of, like, keeping it all straight, but I have to echo what Todd said. Your enthusiasm for this idea is definitely off the charts. And, was it problematic keeping track of everything? Just time travel wise, or did you feel like it was a natural thing for you to do?
Actually, and so here's the funny thing, and I don't want to get too much into the mechanics of it, but there's technically no actual time travel in the book.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. so essentially it's like set in a hotel for time travelers that's connected to like a time port. And the woman who is the house detective is trying to solve a crime where, you know, basically she was like a time cop. Like, she worked in the time stream, but that can sometimes, like, the time radiation can poison you, and it creates this condition called being unstuck, where you kind of like slip around in time a little bit.
Right.
So really the majority of what's happening in the book is her perception is sort of slipping back and forth. So she's experiencing things out of order. Like, she might see something 5 minutes before it happens, or she might suddenly fall into a past memory or something. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the timeline, it actually wasn't that hard. The real challenge of it is that I also wanted it to be kind of like an Agatha Christie style, like, locked room mystery. And that was more complicated, because then it's like writing those sort of like very contained, very claustrophobic stories where you've got a lot of characters who all need some kind of attention, where you've got to be able to, like, throw out red herrings, and you've got to be able to distract the reader and sort of like make them think one thing. Like, that was the hardest part, and that's the part I'm still shoring up. Like, the timeline stuff is actually not that bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the getting that sort of like traditional, like, locked room element in there has been a lot of fun.
That's interesting. Yeah. And, you know, people always ask, like, does it get easier as you go to the next book? And it honestly doesn't, at least in my experience. I find that there's a new challenge, even if you've got the rudimentary stuff, like how to write a novel or the process or the tools, you're always going to get stuck with some random new challenge you didn't anticipate.
Yeah. So listen, we're getting close to where we got to wrap things up, but before we get into the last part of this, I do want to know, because I'm sure people are very excited to get a big dose of Poe Dameron starting tomorrow. Well, I mean, obviously by the time the podcast comes out, the book will bled out a bit. But what are you most excited about when it comes to A, the release of this book, and B, having been able to write that character?
I mean, it was just so funny when they approached me, because if I had created a dream scenario for Star Wars, it would have been this. It would have been, hey, can you write Poe Dameron's origin story? Like, and I'm not just saying that. I mean, of the sequel trilogy, Poe was probably my favorite character. He just felt the most complicated and the most lived in. And so, you know, I went in with eyes open thinking, okay, they're going to give me a roadmap and I'll just follow the roadmap and that'll be the book. But it had so much opportunity for new stuff and new characters. So knowing that you can add to the mythos and you can add characters that people may use later. And I tried to do that too. I tried to use characters that were created in other books or other comics to kind of, to me, that's like the coolest tip of the hat when you use somebody else's character or they use yours. So knowing that now those are out there and that I could kind of not only add to Poe's origin, but to Zori Bliss's origin story. You see her for like 10 minutes in the movie and you're like, who is this person? And now if you read the book, it's there. So the idea that somebody can watch Rise of Skywalker and have these questions about Poe and then just pivot to the book and they're all answered there, that's a huge responsibility. So
yeah,
hopefully I stuck that one.
Yeah. So what are you reading right now?
What am I reading? I just finished Ivy Pachota's These Women, which is fantastic. And it kind of flips the script on the serial killer novel. So instead of following the serial killer, you get to see his crimes through the eyes of the victims. So that I love it because it treats the serial killer not like this, you know, dark genius, but this kind of loser who just happened to be a murderer, and how it affects these women and how it affects the community. And then Ivy's prose is fantastic. So I burned through that pretty fast. And S.A. Cosby's Blacktop Wasteland.
Good. Oh my God.
It's just like, yeah, it's just, you know, I was joking with him just saying, you know, you're the best blurb book out there, but it's all with good, you know, it's all well-deserved. I mean,
yeah, I read that book like 6 months ago or so. It completely blew me away. And I was like, man, this is going to be like the book of the year.
Yeah. And if it isn't, then something's gone wrong. But those are the two big ones. How about you?
I just tore through two books. One was Home Before Dark by Riley Sager, mm-hmm. which was just like, God, that guy just knows how to write a thriller.
He's great.
And also like, and it's a ghost story book. And I had to like, I was reading it at night, like before bed.
Yeah.
And I got so creeped out. I put it down and I was like, I'm going to finish this tomorrow during the daytime. I can't take this right now.
I'm
also a big baby when it comes to horror. And then, and then in practically one sitting, I read Devolution by Max Brooks.
Oh, wow.
It is incredible. Because he wrote World War Z, you know, this is a Bigfoot novel. Wow. And it's like, and what's incredible about it is that like, and again, like this is a conversation that I was having with Todd, author of The Hard Bounce and Rough Trade, which everyone should pick up. The thing that's amazing about it is like the first 100 pages, like it could be like, it's about like this sort of sustainable community up in this like mountain range in the Pacific Northwest that like, mm-hmm. you know, gets cut off from society by a volcanic eruption. And like, you know, it's a huge amount of land and no one knows like they're there or something. Like the prospect of them getting rescued in the midst of like all this chaos is very low. So they're all trying to figure out like, how do we survive for as long as possible without being able to get out of here? And for the first 100 pages, it's pretty much just like you're meeting the characters and it's a survival book. And like, it could have been just that and it would have been great. And then all of a sudden there's just a family of Bigfoots and it's like, and it's so, and the thing that Max does that's incredible is like the book is so smart and well-researched and like it feel like it's meant to be sort of like, it's the journals that of the woman that are found like after they finally found the settlement once it's been abandoned and like, you know, months and months later. Intercut with some interviews with like, you know, the woman's brother and like a local sheriff. And it's just like, you read the book and you're like, there, this feels like it really happened.
Wow.
So,
yeah, I mean, that's the best fiction is the kind that kind of lulls you into that sense of disbelief.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So there's some good reading out there. And right now I'm kind of between The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin or The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. Those are like the two books that are like near the top of my to be read pile at the moment.
Yeah. That N.K. book is on my to read pile as well.
Yeah.
It's great. Cool. Well, it seems like we're reading a ton of good stuff, and I'm excited for The Warehouse to re-enter the world.
Yeah, I cannot wait to get my my Poe Dameron tomorrow.
Yeah, I hope you dig it. This was fun. Thanks for taking a minute.
Yeah. Thanks for the fun chat.
Yeah, anytime.
And now, here's an exclusive excerpt from the audiobook, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio.
Paxton pressed his hand against the front window of the ice cream parlor. The menu board on the wall inside promised homemade flavors. Graham cracker and chocolate marshmallow and peanut butter fudge. Flanking it, on one side, was a hardware store called Pops, and on the other was a diner with a chrome and neon sign he couldn't quite make out. Delia's? Dahlia's? Paxton looked up and down the stretch of the main road. It was so easy to imagine the street bustling with people. All the life this place used to hold. It was the kind of town that could inspire feelings of nostalgia on the first visit. Now it was an echo fading in the white sunlight. He turned back to the ice cream parlor, the only business on the strip not boarded up with weathered plywood. The window was hot to the touch where the sun hit it, and coated in a layer of grit. Looking inside, at the dusty stacks of flared tin cups and the empty stools and the fallow refrigerators, Paxton wanted to feel some kind of regret about what this place must have meant to the town that surrounded it. But he had reached the limit of his sadness when he stepped off the bus. Just the act of being there was stretching his skin to bursting, like an overfilled balloon. Paxton hitched his bag over his shoulder and turned back into the horde shuffling down the sidewalk, trampling the grass jutting through the cracks in the concrete. There were still people coming up in the rear, older folks, people nursing injuries so they couldn't walk as well. 47 people had gotten off the bus. 47 people. Not including him. About halfway through the two-hour ride, when there was nothing left on his phone to capture his attention, he'd counted. Heavy-shouldered men with the calloused hands of day laborers. Stooped office workers grown soft from years of hunching at keyboards. One girl couldn't have been more than 17. She was short and curvy, with long brown braids that reached down to her lower back and skin the color of milk. She wore an old lavender pantsuit, two sizes too big, the fabric faded and stretched from years of washing and wear. The sliver of an orange tag, like the kind used in secondhand stores, stuck out from its collar. Everyone carried luggage. Battered roller suitcases wobbling on uneven pavement. Bags strapped to backs or slung over shoulders. Everyone sweating from exertion. The sun baked the top of Paxton's head. It must have been well past 100 degrees. Sweat ran down Paxton's legs, pooling in his underarms, making his clothes stick. Which was exactly why he wore black pants and a white shirt, so the sweat wouldn't show as much. The white-haired man next to him, the one who looked like a college professor put out to pasture, his beige suit was the color of wet cardboard. Hopefully the processing center was close. Hopefully it was cool. He just wanted to be inside. He could taste it on his tongue, dust blowing from ruined fields. No longer strong enough to keep a grip on anything. It had been cruel of the bus driver to drop them at the edge of town. He was probably staying close to the interstate to conserve gas, but still. The line ahead shifted, drifting to the right at the intersection. Paxton dug in harder. He wanted to stop to pull a bottle of water out of his bag, but pausing at the ice cream parlor had been an indulgence. There were now more people ahead of him than behind. As he neared the corner, a woman launched past him, clipping his side, making enough contact he almost stumbled. She was older, Asian, with a mop of white hair on her head and a leather satchel looped around her shoulder, making a hard push for the front of the pack. But the effort proved to be too much, and within a couple of feet she tripped, went down hard on her knee. The people around her stepped to the side, gave her room. But didn't stop. Paxton knew why. A little voice in his head screamed, "Keep walking." But of course he couldn't. So he helped her get to her feet. Her bare knee was scratched red, a long trail of blood running down her leg to her tennis shoe, so thick the line was black.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us.
For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.